Welcome everybody to this week's mathematical physics seminar. I want to encourage everybody, as always, to be very kind of discursive. You, of course, feel free to unmute and interrupt because it's supposed to be a kind of intimate and lively environment. And if for some reason you're too embarrassed to do that, you can always ask questions in the chat and I will interrupt Suresh. So it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker this week, Suresh Swarathasan from Dalhousie, who will be telling us about geometry of nodal domains of eigenfunctions.
So thank you for the introduction, Theo, and it's a pleasure to be visiting, quote-unquote, the Perimeter Institute today. So my research is mostly analytic, and I guess I get the impression that many people who are attending the seminar today don't necessarily go in that direction. So my talk is really aimed at giving kind of the broad picture with some concrete formulas, and I'll try to keep the gory details essentially the last 10 minutes or so, if I even get to the gory details. But I wanted this talk to be more survey-ish in nature. Okay, so just to start off, okay, I think it's important. So in section one, okay, I'll be giving my introduction. Okay, so that's section one. Okay. And so the two main objects that I want people to keep in mind, okay, is that we are always working on a compact Riemannian manifold without a boundary. Okay, so I always think about surfaces, but more generally, just always think about a compact Riemannian manifold without a boundary. Compact Riemannian manifold, okay, without boundary. And at some point I'll specialize just the surfaces just to make things more concrete, but we'll keep that in mind. Okay, and the main kind of operator, the main differential operator that I'll be considering today, okay, is the positive, okay, Laplace-Beltrami operator. Beltrami operator. So those are the two geometric objects that I'll be looking at today. Okay. And so what does any of this have to do with physics potentially? Okay. Well, section 1.1 is about physical interpretations. Okay, so the main interpretation, at least in my eyes, okay, are the following. Okay, number one, if we were to look at the eigenvalue equation for the Laplace-Beltrami operator, okay, we're going to be getting stationary states for a free quantum particle, right? So let me write that out. When you look at this equation here, so I write lambda squared just for kind of for normalizations in terms of formula purposes, okay? But, and I want my spectrum to be positive. Okay, that's why I put the negative in front of the delta. But, all right, this equation gives stationary states for a free, because there's no potential in the picture. Of course, including a potential would also be very interesting, but just for today, I want to consider a free quantum particle on M, M being sort of my classical environment, okay? And now, okay, we usually call this phi lambda a wave function, all right? It's a certain standard terminology from quantum mechanics. And now, okay, so according to Born, like as in Max Born, okay, if I took the integral over some subset E of the manifold and I just took the square of the eigen function. And then I looked at the Riemannian volume measure, okay? What this is gonna do is this is just gonna give me the probability, okay, that the particle, the quantum particle, is in the set E, okay? So E is going to be, I'll just let it be a non-trivial subset of N. So these kind of wave functions give me some kind of probability distribution, right? And I should emphasize that my spectrum, okay, on a compact Riemannian manifold, I forgot to mention connected, okay, on a, although that doesn't change too much, okay, on a compact Riemannian manifold without a boundary, okay, my spectrum, meaning these eigenvalues lambda squared, they form a discrete set and they go off to infinity, okay, and that's important. So on our particular geometry, okay, I have that the spectrum is just going to be, and I'll write it this way, lambda j squared, where j goes from 0 to infinity, okay, with lambda j squared going off to infinity, okay? And for each j, I get a truly different eigenvalue. So I'm not considering multiplicities or anything right now. It doesn't really matter so much for this talk, okay? These are distinct eigenvalues going off to infinity. Okay. All right. Now that we have this setup, we have these quantum particles or a quantum particle in this classical setting of M. Okay. What is the big question that I kind of involve myself in? Well, it's the following. So the big Q. Okay. Not necessarily the big Q specifically for today, but just the big Q in general. Okay. And this is really following from a paper of Einstein, okay, in 1917. All right. And in this 1917 paper of Einstein, he was studying quantization rules in higher degrees of freedom, okay? And he made a sentence, he made a statement in this paper that was kind of incidental, but it's very apparent that it opened up a whole field of research, particularly in the mathematical direction, okay? So let's see, so I believe, of course, in English, it translated into something like classical statistical mechanics concerns itself mostly with systems of type B, where the microcanonical average equals the time average, okay? So what are systems of type B? Systems of type B are basically what we call chaotic systems, okay? There's some kind of ergodicity occurring in them from a dynamical point of view, okay? So when we take this kind of perspective, what is microcanonical? Microcanonical means that it's the average over some phase space region, okay? And time average means that you're taking the integral of a quantity with over a dynamical trajectory, okay? So it's just the reformulation of ergodicity. Okay, now, following what Einstein said, I would say that this is the main question I concern myself with. So if the classical system, so the classical system for us is just the geodesic flow on M. It's the geodesic flow actually on the phase space T star of M, but I won't get too much into that. Just think about particles, classical particles running around on M and they follow the paths of geodesics, okay? So if this thing is chaotic, whoa. Okay, maybe I should put quotation marks around that. That could mean many things. What are the patterns displayed by the quantum particles, or rather, what are the patterns displayed by the spectrum of the Laplace-Beltrami operator and the eigenfunctions themselves? Okay, so what are the patterns exhibited by spec Laplace and my eigenfunctions here? Okay. All right. And now, okay, let's say using the Bohr correspondence principle, okay, which has to do with the old quantum theory and quantization rules, okay? all Bohr's correspondent principle says, correspondence principle says, is that in some high energy limits, the spectrum and the eigenfunction should sort of reflect in some form or another something happening with the classical dynamics. The long-time classical dynamics informs the high energy quantum dynamics. Okay, so using Bohr's principle, that's a secondary question, Bohr's principle, behaviors for lambda j squared large. Okay. So anyways, this is a question. I don't even know. Maybe there are no answers to this thing. Maybe it's complete nonsense. Okay. Well, I want to give some evidence that it's not totally nonsense. Okay. So what I want to do now is I just want to show some pictures, right? So I'm going to stop sharing my iPad screen and I want to share this. Okay. Okay. Can everybody see this? Everybody's okay? Good. All right. So what we're looking at here is, all right, so this is a compact manifold with a boundary. Okay. But I still think it's informative from the spectral theoretic point of view for the same reasons that a compact manifold without a boundary isn't. Okay. So I know I'm sort of diverging a bit here, but please take this as evidence. Okay. I'm looking at the cardioid billiard, okay, in R2. And I'm looking at eigenfunctions starting at J equal to 758. Okay. So we can see that what you're looking at are the intensity plots. So what I've done, I didn't make this picture. Okay, somebody named Arne Backer at University of Ulm did this. Okay. But what he plotted were the intensity plots of the phi lambdas. So essentially what you're looking at is the regions where phi lambda is positive and negative. Okay. And you can see that in exception for maybe two or three pictures, we see that the kind of the distribution of the eigenfunction is kind of uniform. Okay, of course there's some symmetries, right? But as the eigenvalue is getting higher, you see more and more literally some kind of ergodicity on some quantum level occurring. The eigenfunction is sort of spreading out. Okay. And the cardioid billiard is actually a chaotic dynamic. It produces a chaotic dynamic system. So if I took a billiard ball and I shot it in almost every direction and I didn't have friction on the table, the ball would eventually cover the entire table. Okay. All right. So here's another picture. So this is the Bunimovich Stadium. It has a little bit more of a reputation. And the same thing that's occurring. Okay. In one of the last pictures, you see some sort of concentration of the eigenfunction. It's sort of limiting itself to certain regions, but that's sort of atypical. Okay, that's atypical. Most of the time, you're seeing this sort of distribution in terms of the mass of the eigenfunction across the billiard. Okay. All right. So this is to show that eigenfunctions are sort of satisfying the Bohr correspondence principle, even in the chaotic setting, okay? And I would say that in the integrable setting of dynamics and classical mechanics, okay, the Bohr correspondence principle is, I would say it's pretty well understood, okay? But now in these chaotic settings, writing down eigenfunctions is a lot harder because we don't have the same symmetry. So maybe to put it another way, spectral data in chaotic settings, quote unquote, is actually much more mysterious. Okay, much more mysterious. So I'm going to share my iPad again. Okay. Excuse me. This is a good time to ask questions. Actually, are there any questions? Cool. To get my iPad to go. Okay. So if there are no questions, okay, I'll just continue. All right. Okay, so given that eigenfunctions in these chaotic settings, they're relatively difficult to compute, okay? There are only very few settings where we can actually do them explicitly, like on the sphere, which has a whole lot of symmetries. Also on the flat torus, okay, which is just the unit square, and you just you put periodic boundary conditions on it. Okay, so it's actually a flat manifold. Okay, but in any case, is there something that we could really compute with, even more specifically, to understand these chaotic eigenfunctions? Okay. So Barry in 1977, he's a physicist at the University of Bristol. Okay. He made the claim, okay, that high energy eigenfunctions, okay, like the ones we saw on the Unimovie stadium and on the cardioid billiard, high energy eigenfunctions should actually behave statistically like random linear combinations of spherical harmonics or plane waves. Okay. So high energy eigenfunctions on a chaotic MG they behave statistically in a statistical manner, they behave the same. So I'll write it this way: statistically, most of the time, random combos of plane waves or spherical harmonics. Spherical harmonics are going to be more relevant to today's talk because the formulas are so concrete. Okay. So, all right. So maybe I shouldn't do this too often. I shouldn't go back and forth between pictures. Okay. But I'm going to stop the sharing again, and I'm going to go back to my previous picture. Okay. So can everybody see this? Yeah. Okay. Good. Now, so these pictures were produced using code by Alex Barnett. Okay, at the Flatiron Institute in New York. Okay, what you're looking at is you're looking at a spherical harmonic that was picked randomly, okay, with J, meaning the, you know, I've enumerated my eigenvalues by J, okay? So this is where lambda J squared I'm showing. J corresponds to 163. Okay, and we see that actually the patterns, the intensity plot that the eigenfunction is making is once again spread out, and it's kind of, it looks almost like noise, okay? And then a similar thing happens here when you look at J equal to 256. Okay, actually, in fact, you see even more. In fact, I would even say that as you actually maybe move away from the picture, you see less and less in the details, and it looks essentially like you're looking at a big black dot, okay? So now, how does this help with maybe verifying what Barry said? Okay, so when we look at this picture here, on the left-hand side, we are looking at a high-energy eigenfunction. This is zoomed in. A high-energy eigenfunction on the Bunimovich stadium, okay? And now on the right, you're just looking at just a cap on the sphere for one of these random spherical harmonics. So what this shows is that Barry's prediction is, well, correct, at least for this one instance. Okay, a high energy eigenfunction, a deterministic high energy eigenfunction, okay, can be stood in for by a random spherical harmonic. Okay. Great. So let me get back to now iPad. Okay, great. Okay, excellent. Great. So random combos of spherical harmonics can act as stand-ins for chaotic eigenfunctions. Okay. So now let's give some concrete formulas. Okay, so the model is on S2 with the round metric. Okay, G round. Okay. So I should state, okay, that the spectrum of the Laplacian on the sphere, okay, it's just going to be equal to, I'm going to replace J with L, if everybody's okay with that. So it'll be L times L plus 1, okay, where L goes from 0 to infinity. Okay, so the eigenvalues are like, you know, 3, 6, 12, 20, okay, things like this. And then now, okay, what I want to do is write down a formula for what a random spherical harmonic is going to look like. So I'm just going to call that phi sub L. I'm dropping this lambda now, okay, phi sub L. And so I want this to be an N01 random variable. So I just divide out by the dimension of the eigenspace. So this thing, every eigenvalue equaling L times L plus 1 has multiplicity 2L plus 1. So this means that as L gets big, I have big multiplicities, okay? So I have a lot of eigenfunctions that I can choose from in that eigenspace. And all I do is I just put a Gaussian measure on these big eigenspaces. Okay, and I do that as follows. So here M is gonna go from negative L to L. Okay, I take AM, e to the I m theta. I'm just writing these in spherical coordinates. PLM, cosine phi, okay? So this PLM is just it's just a Legendre function of index ML, okay? And these things here satisfy eigenvalue equation. Okay, and I'm just taking linear combinations of them. And these AMs, okay, they are normal 0, 1, normally, so they're they have mean zero and they have variance one, and they're independently identically distributed. And I do that because, anytime I pick an orthonormal basis in this eigenspace, okay, the distribution of phi L doesn't change. Okay. So that's really why I want my phi sub L to be normal 0, 1. Okay. And normal 0, 1 random variables are very nice. Okay. From the probabilistic standpoint. Okay. So I'm fixing orthonormal bases and I'm just varying. I can vary amongst all orthonormal bases for this eigenspace. Okay. And I can do this as L goes to infinity. Okay, so that's my model. That's a concrete formula. Okay. And we've seen representation of this already. Okay, so now, okay, I would say the big general cue for today, okay, specific to today's talk. Is the following. Okay. Can I further describe, okay, these black and white regions that we were seeing, or in the case of the sphere and the Budimovich Stadium, in the last three pictures I showed, okay, the black and white regions. Can I describe further the regions where the eigenfunction is positive and negative? Okay, I call those the nodal domains. Can we further describe, okay, I call it N of phi L, the nodal domains. Okay, so this is just the complement of the zero set. So these are just X's and S2 such that phi sub L of X is equal to zero. Okay, and I just look at the complement. And I want to do this for L large. Okay. So I call this sort of thing here, I call these the nodal domains. Oops. Nodal domains. Okay. Okay, and in fact, N of phi of L consists of many connected components. Okay, as we saw, I wish I could just show the pictures without having to flip between these files so much, but I will just hope that you remember what I showed to some degree. Okay. I want to understand maybe the number of connected components in N of phi L, the number of nodal domains. Okay. Maybe I want to understand the length of certain nodal domains. Okay, on a statistical basis. Okay. So in fact, the nodal domains are essentially where the quantum particle is most probable to be, okay? I want to look at it kind of away from the zero set. So this is one step towards understanding this probability distribution better, okay? Okay. Okay, so now, okay, let's calibrate ourselves, okay? Describe further. Well, is there a deterministic result telling us how many connected components lie inside of NFIL? Okay, how many black and white regions are there actually in those pictures that I showed you on the sphere? Okay, so there is a deterministic result. And probably people have heard about it at some point in their career, okay? So Richard Courant, okay, as in like the Courant Institute in 53, and actually really Chang in a more geometric setting in 76, okay? Showed that the number of connected components, okay, in this complement, the number of nodal domains, okay, for the phi sub L, okay, this is deterministic, okay, really for any eigenfunction, it's going to be bounded above by L plus 1 squared. Okay, L plus 1 squared. So essentially, the number of nodal domains is bounded above by essentially the eigenvalue. Okay. All right. But now, actually on the sphere, you can cook up examples. You can cook up a sequence of eigenfunctions with L going off to infinity. You can cook up a sequence of eigenfunctions on the sphere, a subsequence that only obtain two nodal domains. Okay. So there's no way to actually bound this thing from below sort of non-trivially. I mean, at least in some more meaningful way in terms of L. Okay. All right, so but one would think that's atypical. It's not, it's very hard to find an eigenfunction that only obtains two nodal domains. Okay, well, this is where some really spectacular work of Nazarov and Sodin comes in. So I want to ask, what does one for a typical eigenfunction on the sphere, given this random model, what are the number of nodal domains it should have? And in fact, we can greatly improve this upper bound. We can make it an asymptotic in the following way, okay? Well, as follows. So this was joint work of Nazarov and, not joint work of myself, but joint work between Nazarov and Sodin, okay? In 2009, and then there was like a great generalization in 2015, okay? And it says that the expected value, okay, with respect to the measure on the eigenspace, for the number of nodal domains, okay, this is going to be equal to this number C0 times L squared plus a little o of L squared, okay? So essentially the number is like a polynomial, okay, to some degree, where the leading order term will be L squared, and then you have this kind of error, which is smaller than L squared, okay? And maybe what's even more, what I find to be like most amazing about this is that if we were to think about the analogous notion of a random eigenfunction on a surface, or a random a random eigenfunction on, let's say, a surface that had big volume, that it had, let's say, genus G, okay, genus 100, okay, well, this C0 is going to be the same. So you'll get the same asymptotic with the C0 being the same. Okay, but the error term will still be little o of L squared, but there's extra information packed in. Okay, so this is universal. Okay, so all I'm trying to say is that this C0 doesn't really depend on S2. Actually, it holds for, okay, more general surfaces. Holds for more general surfaces.
Okay. Suresh, Jeremy asked on the chat, just for you to confirm the formula for the Courant and Chang result. Did you mean the eigenvalue squared, or did you mean just really L plus one squared?
Yes.
So you told us the eigenvalue was L times L plus one. So.
The eigenvalue was L times L plus one, right? So, okay, when I say it's equal to the eigenvalue squared, and I was fibbing. I mean, up to a lower order term, it's equal to that. And you can write down this more generally, but I'm just trying to keep it restricted to the eigenfunction in the sphere.
Okay.
Okay, so the work of Nazarov and Sodin, I mean, certainly they had known about Berry's work. But actually what really inspired their work was what I consider to be a very beautiful piece of science, okay? And in physics. It was written by Bogomol and Schmidt in 2002, and these are two physicists at L'Université d'Orsay, okay? Not too far away from Paris. And what they did is they gave some kind of a percolation model for how nodal domains behave on domains in R2, okay? So they came up with some sort of model that I won't get into too much, but it's rather beautiful. It has to do with actually percolation dynamics. And it was inspired by their work. And Nazarov Sodin just wanted to rigorize what they were saying. Okay, they still didn't totally do it, but they rigorized a portion of what Bogomol and Schmidt were conjecturing. Okay. I should emphasize, I mean, this is really beautiful stuff, this Bogomol and Schmidt's paper. Yeah, I think it's really lovely. Okay, there are some analogous results to those of Nazarov and Sodin by Gaillet and Velchanger, okay, who deal with random sections of high powers of a particular line bundle. Okay, and I guess from the physical point of view, those are also relevant, although I don't know so much about what those represent physically, what line bundles, what certain sections of line bundles mean, like projective line bundles. In any case, okay, I think I will pause here and see if anybody has questions before continuing. No? Everything is understandable or everything is totally trivial?
Can I ask a question? Sure. Just sort of a random question, but you, like, I'm curious if you studied nodal domains for, or did you, like, I think you commented before, did you study nodal domains if you add in a potential, or if you studied this for different sort of second order PDEs?
Yes, in fact, I haven't done that myself, but there are results for semi-classical. So you have to look at this now in the semi-classical setting. At least that's the only setting I know about where nodal domains are studied for Schrodinger equations with potentials. So it is done. I don't know if it has been done randomly, but it has been done deterministically by, I think Toth has had some work. I believe, I think maybe Gilles Lebeau has done stuff with Jerison on this as well.
Okay.
Okay. I will continue. Okay, now we get into what I think is the real good stuff, okay? I want to understand the topology of these domains, okay? So what I mean by that is, the topology of these domains. So the very specific cue for today is the following. Okay, this is what I'm going to answer specifically for the remainder of the talk. Okay, specific cue for today. Okay, what's the typical topology of a kinetic component of the nodal set, of a connected component, okay, of a nodal domain? What's the typical topology of a connected component in N of phi L? Inside N of phi L. Okay, we're going by typical, okay? So in fact, if you were to stare at that picture of the sphere that I gave, okay, and you look very closely, it gets pixelated at some point, but you can still see some fine details. You'll see some domains, like black domains, with multiple white holes in them, okay, but you'll also see lots of domains that are just that have genus that have no holes, so they're simply connected, okay. So by topology, I want to understand what's like, is it typical for a connected component to be simply connected? Or is it more typical for a connected component to have genus one, okay, or two or three or something like this, okay? So let's try to quantify this. What I want to do is I want to set up kind of a delta measure, okay, on the set of nodal components. I want to put a delta measure, okay, of some form, a linear combination at least, on NFI L as follows, okay? So consider 1 over, okay, I take the number of NFI L, okay? And what I do now is I multiply that by the sum over the components in NFI L. And then what I do is I just take the delta function of the number of holes component has, okay? And I'm going to call that mu of, maybe I'll go to the next line. I'm gonna call this now mu of phi L. Okay, so let's suppose that my n of phi lambda had 6 components, and 3 of them had 2 holes, and 3 of them had 1 hole. Okay, so then I'm going to get delta of 1, delta of 1, delta of 1, like delta of 1 plus delta of 1 plus delta of 1 plus delta of 2, delta of 2, delta of 2. Okay, so the delta of 1 component has weight 3, and the delta of 2 component has weight 3. Okay, of course, it's not as simple now when we consider high energy, okay? But I want to consider this, all right? Okay, so I want to say that this is a random measure, right? It's changing. This measure is changing depending on the phi lambda I give you or I select on the event. So this is a random measure, okay? And now, okay, this measure was studied by Sarnak, okay, and Wigman in 2018, okay, who said the following, okay. What I want us to do is I want us to think about this measure as L goes to infinity. So a phi lambda is like one of the pictures I showed you, okay? So take many of the, fix L, take many of the phi lambda, do your count, okay? Compute this measure. Okay, you get many random measures that are giving you some sort of tallies. Now I want you to take these series of pictures, make L get bigger. Take the series of pictures, make L get bigger. What Sarnak and Wigman show is as you let L go to infinity, okay, what's going to happen is you're going to get actually a universal deterministic measure, okay? So the tallies actually converge to each other across the clips, all right? So let me write that down. You're going to have now mu of phi L. This is going to converge as L goes to infinity. Okay, it's going to converge to a measure that depends only on the dimension 2, and I say this number 1, meaning it has to do something with the spectral windows. Okay, so but I just keep that, maybe I shouldn't write that. Maybe I'll just forget about that right now. Okay, it depends on dimension 2 and something else. Okay, and this thing is a universal meaning I get the same measure, okay? I get the same measure no matter what, I get the same measure no matter what surface I'm looking at, okay? And it's deterministic, okay? There's no randomness there. And it's a probability measure. It's truly a probability measure, okay? So that means somehow that the topology isn't leaking, right? Like as you're taking these sequence of pictures and you're going forward and you're doing your tallies, okay? In the limit, you're not seeing certain topologies getting missed, okay? So it's a probability measure on the positive integers, positive integers with 0. And moreover, and the supremum, okay, because Z union 0 is a discrete set, okay? So the support is actually all of Z. Okay? So one way to think about this is that a random eigenfunction, when you let L go to infinity, on average, okay, it's going to see all genuses, okay? I mean, it'll see all topologies as you let L go to infinity, okay? And it'll see it in some sort of positive proportion way, okay? Okay. So now, what I want to say is, what I want to understand is the following, okay? Let's suppose I want to understand the components of this measure, okay? Just to make things concrete, okay? What is mu sub 2 evaluated at 0? Okay, like what proportion of nodal domains, okay, have genus 0? What proportion of nodal domains have genus 1? Okay, and this is what this measure is essentially telling you. Okay, so there were some numerics. There were some numerics done by Alex Barnett, the fellow who helped me generate those pictures on the sphere. Okay, so numerics done by Alex give the following. So using fast Fourier transforms and Monte Carlo simulations, he got an approximation. So this is not rigorous. It's just, it's, you know, like it's got MATLAB code. Okay. You should have 91%, almost 92% of nodal domains having genus zero. Okay. So most of them are going to have, most of them are just going to be like circular disks. Okay. Or some perturbation of that. All right, now, when you look at mu to 1, evaluated at 1, okay, there's a big drop-off. You should only expect about 5% to have genus 1, okay? And he gets some higher values, too. I won't give the table, but there's some big drop-off, okay? All right. So, okay, before I continue... Yes.
Did he do enough numerics to like, I mean, do you have a sense, maybe you'll tell us this either numerically or rigorously. Do you know what, like actually what speed the drop off is?
Yes, I will give you the conjecture. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Does anybody, that's a good question, Theo. Before I continue with answers, does anybody have questions? Further questions? Do I have until 3:25?
Sure.
Okay. 25? Okay, great. So in these last 10 minutes, I'm going to give answers. Okay. So section 3, answers. Rigorous answers. Okay. All right. So in some joint work with Matthew de Courcy Ireland, okay, who is a former student of Sarnak, Matthew de Courcy Ireland, his name is hyphenated. Okay. So this is... Okay, we give actual rigorous lower bounds to the zero atom and the one atom. Okay, and okay, so we have mu zero, mu one. Okay, so maybe it's a bit maybe underwhelming. Okay, but actually, it took some work to show it's actually bounded below by 10^-5. Okay. Okay, and now, okay, here you have actually the one atom being bounded above by something even worse, okay? But at least it's a number, okay? And part of the reason why these numbers are maybe in need of wanting, okay, in spite of our hard work, okay, is the fact that it's the Gaussian measure that punishes you, okay? The Gaussian measure really punishes you. Okay. Once you're like an order one distance away from the origin or from the mean, okay, you have really small probabilities. Okay. So it's very hard to sort of analyze the mean in some ways in an effective way. So this is part of it. Okay. All right. Now, so there is a conjecture. So one of the conjectures, so this conjecture actually appears in this beautiful work of Bogomolny and Schmidt. Okay. So the work of Bogomolny and Schmidt, actually, they didn't write it this way because they didn't know about Sarnak-Wiedemann's work. This predated Sarnak-Wiedemann. Okay. They actually did the count for the topologies of these domains. And their conjecture, which is one of the goals I have, okay, it's one of the things in my research program, okay, is to show that there exists a C such that for all n greater than or equal to n zero, okay, you're gonna have mu to one having this kind of decay rate, C n to the -187, okay? divided by 91. Okay, this negative 187 divided by 91, or rather the 187 divided by 91, this is actually the, this is the critical percolation exponent, okay, for lattices. Critical percolation exponent for lattices. And this was the model that Bergamoni and Schmidt used, okay? And in fact, Alex's, I wanna say that it's important to mention this, that Barnett's numerics confirm. Barnett's numerics confirm the goal. Or the conjecture. But I want to know. Okay. So in fact, there's quite a lot of machinery that goes into the proof that Matthew and I executed. Okay. And it uses some elements of Nazarov's and Soden's work, but it also uses some elements from sphere packing, actually. Maybe if I have time, I'll get into it, but I want to speak about another kind of geometric binning procedure that you can analyze as well. Okay, so let's think about a new binning of topologies. Okay, so we binned up the topologies before by just counting holes. Okay, now let's say new binning of topologies. Okay, so let me ask this question here. Okay, suppose let's fix a non-vanishing vector field, okay, on the sphere. Okay, take a non-vanishing vector field, and now I want you to count the number of domains that are tangent to the vector field k times. Okay, so count the number of vector fields that are tangent one time, two times. Oh, it's actually always going to be greater than two, just because of hop mapping. Okay, so how many natal domains are going to be tangent twice, three times, four times, five times, six times, okay? Tangent to V K times. Okay. So in some ways, this is related to the index theorem from topology, okay? Okay. So I can start binning up my nodal domains this way, and this would be sort of an alternate way in some sense, right, to understand holes. Okay, one would think that if you had one hole, right, you would be tangent to V four times. Okay, if you had two holes, you would be tangent to V six times. Okay, and so on and so forth. If you are simply connected, you would be tangent to V twice. Okay, that's sort of the heuristic. Okay. So in joint work with Wigman, okay, 19. So this recently appeared in TAMS, okay, in transactions, okay. There exists now, I'm gonna call this mu1v, okay, and what this is equal to, this is a deterministic measure defined in a similar manner to how Sarnak and Wigman did it. What I'm going to do is take J inside of 2Z, but this is greater than zero. I want to look at all the positive integers, the positive even integers. Well, excuse me, I'm actually giving you the formula now. This tangent measures, which counts the number of the proportional domains that are tangent K times. This measure is actually supported only on the even integers, okay? Cool. And V, the J, okay? So maybe I should write it this way. In other words, okay? If I looked at the expected number of nodal domains, okay, that are tangent to V K times, okay? This is going to be equal to C0K V L squared plus some remainder when K is even, and this thing will be little o of L squared, okay, for K odd, which just means that when you look at this measure, essentially, there are fewer and fewer domains that will have an odd number of tangencies. Okay, so you can't really, most things are gonna look like this. Okay, rarely can you have something, so if the vector field was straight, you'd have this happening. Okay, rarely can you get something like this. 1, 2, 3. Getting something like that is atypical. Okay, so this kind of cache-y shape. Okay. And maybe I should, well, I don't think I have any time to go through, but that is okay. And I think I will just stop right here.
The floor is open for questions.
Do you have any heuristic explanation of why the functions seem to have this pattern of very dark patches, very light patches, and a very sharp gradient in between?
In the pictures, in the green pictures?
For example, I mean, maybe this was just kind of a figment of how the pictures were drawn, right? The plots you showed that were black and white,
yep.
Right? They were really black and white. There was very little gray in between.
Oh, yeah, no, there's a, yes, that's really just because the pictures aren't as detailed as the green ones. So it was really just meant to show where the eigenfunction was positive and negative. You'll definitely see a lot. I mean, you won't, the gradients, as you say, okay, these sort of derivatives, there's a bound on how big they can get. So you won't ever really get a realistic, like if you really showed the fading, you would have more fading in the picture. That's what I'm trying to say.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. No, it wouldn't be like some kind of delta function on the black and white.
So if I was following, this is all for the round two sphere. Is it sort of, what happens, do you know what happens if you kind of use other geometries, either sort of close to round or very far from round?
Yes, so that's one of the beauties of the general work that Nazarov and Sodin came up with, right? So let's suppose that, okay, so let's suppose I took a surface of negative curvature, okay, so it has a positive genus. So it's generic that the spectrum will be simple, okay? So as a result of it being simple, you can't just take one eigenfunction and expect it to be random. So you have to be now taking big windows, okay? So even in these big windows, okay, when you take the windows large enough so that way you can get multiplicities via the Weyl law, okay, you will end up getting another universal constant, but the universal constant will depend now on the dimension 2, and the width alpha, which in our case alpha is equal to 1. On the sphere, you can let the width be 1, meaning you can take an eigenspace. Okay, and so there exist universal results that Nazarov Sodin came up with in these more general settings, and this work that I have with Wigman is similar.
Kasia has her hand raised.
I would like to understand that conjecture you made with an estimate. So there was this estimate with a funny power, which was the percolation critical exponent.
Mm-hmm.
So what is, I mean, what is there a good reason for that number, for that power? Yes, this one.
Mm-hmm. Is there a good reason for it? It's really, I think, yes, I mean, it really, I don't understand percolation theory so much yet, but it just seems to, somehow reflect very, okay, so in this high energy limit, the percolation model really is an accurate describer of what's happening in the high energy limit. So Bogomolny and Schmidt's kind of numerical heuristic work is what we should believe. So, mm-hmm.
I see. So you think that this kind of heuristic behavior that they describe is should actually be really what's going on? Like,
yes,
that you can put some mathematics behind it.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
But like one of the handicaps, I would say, is that you know, understanding percolation even in the setting for the lattice, understanding certain kind of subtle estimates, or rather getting subtle estimates, actually prevents progress even in terms of just percolation theory. So even under, like, actually showing that the percolation exponents are what they are given different, like, simple models is really quite hard.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Any further questions? I don't see any more. I'm sure Suresh is available online, but I think we should thank him for an excellent talk.